The title of the sermon is, What in the World is Going On? Now, I'm sure that all of you have been overwhelmed, as I have been, with all of the things that are going on in this world right now. You've got the political scene going on. They talk about all the time, all the Republican wannabes for president, and they're bickering back and forth and throwing mud at each other and doing all the things that they normally do. And so that's overwhelming and discouraging, number one. Number two, you've got the financial situation in this country and the threats of shutting down the government, which, of course, they'll never let happen because they want their pay. And you have foolish decisions by the administration, you know, stopping this pipeline and all these things. Anyway, so you have all these fights and arguments, and we need this pipeline very, very dramatically because it will help us be less dependent on the Middle East oil. The oil sands, I don't know if you know this, but the oil sands up in northern, it's Alberta, I believe, have more oil than the Middle East. And it's the oil, in case you don't know what oil sands mean, the oil is mixed with sand, literally. They have to heat that sand to melt the oil out of the sand and then return the sand back to the land. And, of course, there's always the conservationists worried about ruining all the things. And so, but they've come up with more and more efficient ways of doing that. And they are producing more and more oil. And they certainly could be one of our chief suppliers. And it's a very important thing. Their threat is, okay, you don't approve the pipeline. Well, then we'll put a pipeline through Western Canada right out to Vancouver, and we'll ship the oil to China. How do you like them apples? We don't want that to happen. So I'm very disappointed in our president in his decision, but that's his way of doing business, and that's his business. So all of that's going on, plus all of our economy, or the economy in the country being very, very poor and having all these people out of work and thousands of people every month applying for unemployment. And we're borrowing money from China, and it's just a big, giant mess. All right, so now add on top of that thing number three, you have Europe, which is probably pretty confusing to most people, and which I would like to help clarify. And I want to focus on the European effect on the United States, because it definitely will affect us, and it's part of prophecy. And we're beginning to see that unfold before us. And it's important that as much as I can try to put this in simple terms so that the average person can understand, because you hear all these acronyms being thrown around. You hear, oh, there's a big conference over in Europe, and they're going to solve it this Friday. And Friday comes, and they didn't solve anything. The stock market went up because they looked like they might do something, but then they didn't. And then it goes back down again on Monday, and it just goes up and down, up and down. Because there is nothing right now that is sure and is firm and is a real solution. Because people don't agree. They don't agree here, and they don't agree over there. And so it's important for us to understand what's happening, because you are seeing, we are seeing, the fulfillment of the prophecies that not we have made, but the Bible has predicted, and that the church has talked about for well over 50 years. You're seeing them happening right before you, and you need to realize that that is what's happening, because back in the 50s, not too long after World War II, we were preaching out of the, you know, based on the prophecies of the Bible, that Germany would rise again. Germany was flat on their back. And no one could believe that that would ever happen. Well, right now, Currently, Germany is the only country in Europe that is strong enough to bail out Europe. They can do it. But I'll talk more about why they are reluctant to do it as we go along. Okay, I'm going to read this from a minister who was a student at Ambassador College over in England during the early 60s. He said, studying Bible prophecies about 10 nations rising in Europe in Pasadena was interesting because evidently he spent about a year in Pasadena and then got sent over to England and completed his courses over there. But studying them while living in Britain and occasionally traveling to Europe was fascinating. Seeing firsthand, now this is back in the early 60s, 15 years after World War II, Germany's still pretty bad shape. Seeing firsthand huge differences between European countries brought one question to mind. What would make these quite distinctive nations give up their own sovereignty to fulfill this prophecy? The ten horns which you saw, quote out of Revelation 17, the ten horns which you saw are ten kings who have received no kingdom as yet, but they receive authority for 1 hour as kings with the beast. These are of one mind, and they will give their power and authority to the beast. So these ten kings, these ten nations, are going to support the leader, the physical leader. And, of course, there will be the false prophet who will be the religious leader, and we can figure out already who that we don't know who it's going to be, but we already know the entity that it's going to come from. Those nations certainly weren't of one mind back then. Believe me, have you ever seen The Incredible Men and Their Flying Machines? Have you ever seen that movie? That is hilarious. Now, it's so funny because it's so true. You know, the French making fun of the Germans. A German officer can do anything. You know, and he's there while the plane's flying, going into the water, trying to read the instruction book. And the French mocking the Germans in front of the hangar. I mean, just hilarious. And what makes it so funny is it is true. Those are the huge differences between the different ethnic groups and the nationalities there. It just showed it so clearly. And it was very funny, but very accurate. And so with all these very strong cultural differences, how in the world are they ever going to get together? It didn't seem logical, and it was hard for people to believe it. Of course, all we could do was speculate. And believe me, unfortunately, as students, we speculated a lot. We drew charts, and we had things all figured out, and we were all wrong. So I don't draw charts anymore because it's a waste of time. You can't know what's going to happen. All you can see is what God prophesies is an outline. And you and I have to wait to see what story fills the outline. You know, you have an outline of a book. It doesn't tell you the story. It just gives you the outline, the main points. You have to read the story to see how each one of those points gets filled in. God gives us little glimpses of some of the story, but we have to just wait patiently, see how it's going to happen, because we don't know. And when it does happen, then you go, oh, I see how that's working. Well, we are in the process right now of seeing it, and we need to be aware of it. We can't just sit here and go, oh, well, this is a big mess out there in the world, and turn and keep doing what we're doing. We have to be aware that prophecy is being fulfilled right in front of us. But he said, of course, all we could do is speculate. But the rise of Hitler provided a clue. He came to power during the financial disruptions caused by high inflation in the 1920s and the severe unemployment during the Great Depression of the 30s. So it seemed to my classmates and me that the likely catalyst would be another severe financial catastrophe. Well, guess what we have? In desperate situations, people often choose desperate solutions. And this is what is transpiring now. For the last few days, U.S. stock markets have seemed bipolar, if you know what that is. Wildly down one day and wildly up the next. Some say the volatility comes from U.S. Treasuries being downgraded and congressional gridlock. Whatever the cause, of course, there's so many causes, no one can really predict everything. That surely adds to the problem. But many financial authorities claim the underlying problem is unrelenting debt crisis in Europe. Should one country, now this is important to remember here, should one country default on their debts, the large European banks they're indebted to could go under. And I'm going to explain why that is. Why that is a fact of life right now. They know if one of these countries just completely defaults, these banks have no backup. Should that happen, many think major U.S. banks will follow, because we also lent European nations money. A major catastrophe will happen. Today, the volatility seems to be diminishing, and there's hope markets are stabilizing. However, the debt crisis is far from resolved. They really haven't resolved it yet. It just put a little oil on the water, calm things down. And Mr. Obama's lead-from-behind approach makes the world seem rudderless, sad to say. It's easier to imagine a crisis that could make the nations of Europe decide to get behind a single leader. While there's no such leader on the scene today, it is much easier to picture happening than it was almost 50 years ago. We don't see anybody in that position or of that stature at this point, but the circumstances are building as a base to promote that kind of thing. Now, you might not understand, and probably don't understand, this term of sovereign debt. What in the world does that mean? Well, the Europeans are still searching for an easy way out of their sovereign debt crisis. Sovereign debt is money loaned to governments such as Greece, Italy, and the U.S. Okay, that's what sovereign debt is. If a bank loans money to countries such as Greece, Italy, and the U.S. For the last few months, the Europeans would hold conferences on fixing the problem, and stock markets around the world would surge. Days later, the stock markets would plunge because the underlying problems were not resolved. They talked about it, they threw up possible solutions, but nobody really came up with an answer. Okay, so it all has to do with the money the banks have lent all these countries to support their socialist ideas so that you could retire at 51 or 55 with a full income or, a very nice, comfortable income with all the medical things and so on. And, of course, the people in Greece were used to that. And just like, Margaret Thatcher? She says, socialism works great until you run out of other people's money. Well, they ran out of other people's money. They ran out of all the money they borrowed. They ran out of the money they had, and they can't continue to support that. Their debt is greater than their gross national product. Can you understand? I make, in other words, if I'm making $10,000 a year, your debt overhead is $15,000 or $12,000. Now, how are you going to pay that off? I mean, just ridiculous. That is unsustainable. So you patch it, you stretch it, you do all these things. Doesn't fix the problem. It just, like they talk about, kicks the can down the road. So that's the condition Italy and Greece and probably Portugal and Spain are in. Definitely we know Greece is, and if Italy isn't, it's very, very close. But they've been taking nice care of themselves all these years, and finally they ran out of other people's money. Unfortunately, the banks lent them that money, And as you're going to see, they don't have anything to back it up. For the last few months, Europeans, well, I already read that. Okay. The Wall Street Journal, here recently, on the 12th or on the 3rd of December, explained why European banks face such trouble. Now, this is the reason. It's important for you to understand because it will help you when you hear these things now on the news, instead of it all being a big confused, conflab of information that doesn't seem to make sense to the average person, hopefully you'll understand what's happening and you can kind of track it and listen carefully and it'll make more sense. Okay, a European bank, why the European banks, I should say, face this problem. Western banks operate using, now, how is it pronounced? Basel? Basel Bank Capital Standards. What is that? All right, bankers meet in Basel, Switzerland. And that's up in the north, what you look, northwest part of Switzerland, up near France and so on. Okay, bankers meet in Basel, Switzerland to establish, now these are bankers from all over the world, to establish lending standards for banks. In their view, corporate loans were the most risky, requiring an 8% capital held against those loans. Okay, that means you have 8%, whatever you loan out, you loan $100, 8% of it is kept in cash in your bank against that loan. Okay, so you have some capital in your bank. Because, you know, banks don't care what the interest rates are. This is what my bank manager explained to me. We talk fairly often. Not because I have a whole lot to talk to him about, but because we've gotten to be kind of good friends and we kind of catch up with each other on what's going on, interest rates and what's forecast and so on. He said, we don't care what the interest rates are. I said, well, what do you mean? He said, we make our money off the difference. Okay, so if the interest rate is 5%, they loan it to you. They get it for 5%, I should say. Their interest rate is 5%. They loan it to you for 7%. They make 2%. All right, if the interest rate is 1%, they loan it to you maybe for 2 or 2.5%. They still make 1.5%, 2%, whatever their margins are. So they don't care what the interest rate is. They're making money on the difference between what they can borrow from the government and what they turn around and loan it to you for. So, just so you understand how that little game works. Why do, when you go to buy a new car, oh, I got to know the finance people and the sales managers years ago of this Cadillac dealership because almost every year I would trade my car in and get a new one or a near new one. I usually buy a demonstrator or something. And it was in those days, I got the best deduction, and the Cadillac was the best investment to put high miles on. I couldn't, you couldn't lease a car for as cheap as I could do it because I was putting 40 plus thousand miles every year on the car. So I'd buy a new one, I'd drive it for 50,000 miles, and I would trade it in. It would hold its value better than other used cars. Anyway, I would wait. I would wait for the snow to be quite deep, and it would be in either towards the end of January, towards the end of February, when they hadn't seen a customer all month, and they were hurting for their month's numbers. And I would come in there during the week in the evening, and they would see me coming, and they would go, oh, no, here he comes, because they knew I was going to beat him up, and we would make a deal. But they always went along with it because they knew it was a repeat deal. Then I learned from the sales manager there about why they, I always did it through the bank, but why they wanted to finance your car. Do you know why the dealership wants to finance your car? Because they get, just like the bank, a piece of the action for 3 years, 5 years, however long you, they're getting a percentage every month. So they not only make the money on the car, or even if they didn't make the money on the car, if they just sold it break even, if they can finance it, they're getting income for the next 3 to 5 years from you. And they want to sell you all the things that they can. And even their computers are rigged. And I won't tell you, but I caught the guy. And when I caught him in the finance area, figuring things, suddenly the power went off and his computer stopped and he couldn't figure things out anymore. Because they put a little percentage in there for themselves. The finance guy, he pops a little percentage in there for himself for 1 year. So you're paying him commission. It's just all, there are landmines. When you walk through the front door of the dealership, there's one landmine after another. If they don't get you here, they get you another place. Believe me, they ain't going to lose. So very upsetting, frustrating situation to go through. But you have to understand how the game is played, and you've got to get prepared ahead of time. Well, that's kind of the way this whole world is, and they're all out for themselves. All right, well, now I got off the subject here. Okay, so this is important here as far as that backing is concerned. They thought that the loans for business loans were more risky, so they wanted to have 8%. The mortgage loans, just regular mortgage loans, were safer, they felt, so 4%. But mortgage-backed securities, MBS, you'll hear that thing, a mortgage-backed security, where they took all these terrible, awful, terrible loans, which brought this economy down here a number of years ago, and they bundle them together. That's a mortgage-backed security, okay? And you buy a bundle of all these mortgages. You don't know who's and what, where it is, but it's a bundle. And that's supposed to be really, really safe. So they view that much safer. Only problem was there were a whole bunch of bad mortgages listed in there or involved in there, which people would never pay back. Of course, they didn't tell anybody that. And so they only had 1.6 or, you know, barely 1.5% that they held back for capital. But this encouraged the bank to sell lots of those because they didn't have to keep much capital. They could just loan this money out, make the differences that we're talking about, and they didn't have to have all kinds of money sitting there. But the assumption of their safety was wrong. So when the value of the mortgage-backed securities began to drop, which it did like a rock, and some mortgage banks securities went down to zero, and people had their there was a town over in Norway who invested their retirement money for the town into these mortgage backed things, and basically they said, well, are you telling me this is not worth anything? And the bankers in New York said, that's right. Well, and they exchanged not so pleasant comments to each other, and that was it. Too bad, buddy, you just lost. They thought they had a real secure deal with a good interest rate, and suddenly the value of that package they bought, it was just like if you buy a bond and you're going to get so much interest on it every month, and all of a sudden the bond value goes down to nothing. It's worthless. Now, not only do you not get the interest, you don't have the money anymore. It's just valueless. But the assumption of the safety was wrong, so when the value of these things dropped and the other banks were in big trouble, this led to the bailouts. So that was really the cause of the whole thing, just so you understand what happened here in 2008. Now the current crisis, this is the problem. In their wisdom, the Basel rule makers were so confident that sovereign debt, lending to countries, hey, that's a good deal, they'll always pay back, would be repaid, even Greece and Italy. They decided that no reserves were needed to back those loans. Lenders could loan as much money to the government as they wanted with no reserve requirements. Now they're struggling to stay solvent, and there's no easy way out. So they have no cash reserves to back up any of those loans. They have nothing. They just write the paper, give them the money, thank you very much, pay us the interest, we're going to be doing great. Well, now they're in big trouble. If one of those countries defaults, they have zero. It's now clear that the rulemakers in Basel misjudged all four risk categories. They had it totally, all four categories, reverse. Today, the least risky is corporate debt. Slightly more is mortgage debt. Mortgage-backed securities are now considered very risky, and sovereign debt is the worst of all. The Basel bankers priced the risks exactly backwards, and since all Western banks follow the same rules, they all share the same sovereign debt crisis. I hope that makes it a little clearer. It's still hard to understand. Paul quoted this out of 1 Corinthians 1 and verse 19. It is written, he was quoting from Isaiah, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise and bring to nothing the understanding of the prudent. These great wise bankers, who everybody was trusting, and they had their meetings, got it totally wrong. Can you believe it? So now here we sit with banks that are, you know, biting their nails, hoping that they can come up with some way, if one of these countries totally defaults, to keep from going out of business. We can see the sad results all around us. So God's servants continue to pray, your kingdom come and your will be done as it is in heaven, quoted from Matthew 6, verse 9. Just recently I read, just last night actually, that China decided out of the clear blue skies, they say, to begin to charge tariffs on cars that are being sold by us to China. General Motors, Chrysler, cars that go in there can have as much as 10% tariff, which of course caused our, you know, the prices of our vehicles to go way up in comparison to the Chinese vehicles that are being made, and that stops a lot of our trade. And of course, the Congress has all bent out of shape and upset about it. And you'll probably hear on the news, they're trying to figure out how to respond back to China. China is taking us to the cleaners and have been for years. What Donald Trump has said on TV is correct. He said they're laughing at us and they're taking our money because we don't know how to negotiate with them. And that's true. All agree to... And then the meetings they've been having, in Europe, with all the different countries, all the countries agreed to sign, the ones that were in the EU, this new agreement to be more rigid in their financial affairs, except Britain, which we already know from prophecy, Britain is not going to be one of the 10 nations. It'll be one of the countries that is going to be persecuted by the 10 nations. So, this gives us a little bit of background of what we have understood as far as an outline is concerned, what we've understood for many, many, many years. The Church of God has preached this. Mr. Armstrong was preaching it back in the 30s and 40s. And in fact, when World War II was being going on, he thought that that was the fulfillment of it then, because all the things lined up. But it turned out, of course, that wasn't the case. But it's also fits the prophecies which we'll read about here, because it indicates that here was this leadership, this power, and then it went down. But it's going to get resurrected again. It's going to come back stronger than ever. Here's the interesting thing. Right now, in all these meetings, and I've heard a number of commentators, financial people say this, and even Prime Minister Merkel, the lady who is the Prime Minister of Germany, indicated, you know, they know that they're the strongest country in Europe. They have the ability to bail Europe out. They have the ability, like we do, to print money. And they could take care of the problem. But they also know that their reputation from World War I and World War II is not too hot. And nobody wants to be under the thumb of Germany, because if they bail them out, then they will be telling these countries, now you have to retire at so-and-so age, you're only going to get this, and they'll be, if they're going to bail them out, they will now be telling them what to do. You will do it and you will like it. And they know that. So they're very reluctant in doing it. Right now they have not agreed to do this. And they keep going around and around and around. We know from the Bible that they eventually will. When will that happen? I don't know. But just think about it. Just think about this. Here Germany was bombed into oblivion. I mean, there was nothing left of those cities. People are going around with the wagons and the carts, and it was terrible. And now here we see 50 years later, or 60 years later, once again, Germany industrially and very, very diligently has worked very, very hard, and now they are the strong man or the strong country of Europe once again. The only country in the European community, the EU, that has the power to bail out the rest of the countries and to be the leader. But they already know that people aren't going to like that idea, especially the Frenchmen. They aren't going to like it. None. I'm not going to tell French jokes, but I'm tempted. Anyway, I'm not here to beat up on the Frenchmen. But they're not going to like it at all, because they look at themselves as the leaders, but they aren't the leaders. Germany is, though. And it's just a matter of time when this all comes together. Now, I could not believe it. We were in New York area when, I mean, here we've been preaching this thing about the European community, and we have been saying that the 10 nations, you know, there's more than 10 nations right now, but eventually this is going to boil down. How that's going to happen, I don't know. But it's already beginning to go in that direction. The weak ones are being peeled off, and the strong ones are going to be solidified. But there we were in New York City, and the New York Times had page after, and there must have been, I don't know, 10 pages advertising the European community, the EU, and they had their flag with their stars, you know, all around in a circle, and they spent lots and lots of money to advertise in New York City to let everybody know that the European community was now happening. And they introduced, of course, the euro and all of these things, and I thought to myself, here we have been saying this for all these years, this is what's going to happen, and these guys are broadcasting it, paying for all this advertising to tell the world, yeah, that we're doing this, look at. I just started laughing. I just thought, wow, this is no secret. I mean, you know, just think a little bit. This is the beginning of it. Now, that was 20 years ago. Yeah, that was about, I think, around 1990 or so when that began to happen. And, of course, you know the wall fell down way faster than any one of us ever thought it would happen. All of a sudden, one day, woke up, and the wall was down. So things can happen very quickly. On the other hand, look at 20 years have gone by, and the European community and people, oh, the euro is that's the way we want to go. We're going to buy our oil, and we want it paid for in euros. We don't want that American dollar anymore. Well, they are fleeing like rats off the ship right now. They don't want to get euros anymore because the euro is beginning to go down. If the euro takes a tank, which it could and probably will, then it will look good temporarily for the U.S. dollar, but it won't end up being good. So because right now the U.S. dollar is up, back up to around 80 cents, had been down in the low 70s. It's going up. Euro is going down. Europe is in a, what did we just read here, a financial problem right now. And if it gets worse and worse, then people will begin to make desperate decisions. And if some big, strong individual comes along and offers all kinds of solutions, just like Hitler did, people will grab onto it. But anyway, you're seeing prophecy being fulfilled one step at a time. Now, look, 20 years have gone by that this has been going on over there, and they're trying to get their act together and trying to work out their agreements, and these countries weren't in agreement to start with, and they've had all, you know, who's going to be the president overseeing this, and they had meeting after meeting through the years. Now they've got a financial crisis. Where will it go from here? Will it be another 10 years, 20 years? I don't know. But you see the foundation of this thing coming together. All the facts are beginning to focus now. And guess who's coming out to be the strong player? Germany. Everybody knows it. Everybody sees it. They don't like it. They don't look at it. It's like, I don't like that, and I don't want to do it. Because they don't appreciate Germany being in charge again, because they're afraid of that. So, we'll see what transpires. All right, let's go to Matthew 24. This is a good, real simple starting point. Interesting, the sermonette had to do with Daniel, which we'll also read about. Okay, we know when the disciples asked Matthew 24, what's the sign of your coming? We've read this many times. He's talking about not letting people deceive you. People would come to try to say that they were coming in the name of Christ when they weren't. And then he says, wars and rumors of wars. Okay, well, we certainly have that. See that you not be troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. Then he goes on and says, these things are also going to be happening, for nation shall rise against nation. I mean, you know, turn on the news at any time, and you will see that happening. Nation rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. There shall be famines, pestilence, earthquakes in different places. These are only the beginning of sorrows. And then it gets into more serious things, which haven't transpired yet. These things are already happening. He said, well, that's just the beginning. That's the start. And they're intensifying through the years. All of these things that Christ predicted are getting worse and worse and worse. And, of course, you see mankind going down the tubes, as they say, morally, and the people are getting more and more desperate to take care of themselves. Because the next phase, you start to get into the persecution, and then eventually the tribulation. But we're not in that right now. We're here. And so we want to look a little bit at where we are. Okay, let's go to Daniel, the second chapter. And this is the kind of the overview. And interesting, when you read this, Daniel 2, this is the chapter about the big image. And I won't read all of it, but we'll read towards the end here. The king had this dream. He knew that the sorcerers and the people that he went to for advice would just feed him a line many times, whatever sounded good, keep him happy. So in order to foil them and to find out whether they really knew what they were talking about, he wouldn't tell them what the dream was. And the sorcerers went, well, nobody ever does that. There's no way we can help you unless you tell us what the dream is. And, of course, once he tells them the dream, then they can make up whatever kind of prophecy they wanted out of it. So he wouldn't tell them who it was. And they said, if you can't answer these things, then you'll all get killed. And they were seeking to kill Daniel and his friends. And Daniel said, wait, king, give me a little time, and I will tell you what the dream was. And he immediately went back to his three friends, and he said, we better pray and fast here so that God will give us the answer and that he will show us the secret of this particular prophecy or this dream. And they did it because, well, their lives were dependent on it. And so God blessed them in verse 19 and revealed what the dream was that the king had. So he gets a hold of the king and lets the king know, I can tell you what this dream means. Or first of all, I can tell you what the dream was, and I will tell you what it means. So if you jump over to verse 31, chapter 2, it says, O king, you saw and behold a great image. I'm going to get the Revised Standard or the new, more understandable translation here. I get stuck in the King James. Okay, we went 231. Okay, you, O king, were watching, and behold, now he's telling him the dream that he had, and a great image, this great image, whose splendor was excellent, stood before you, and its form was awesome. Now you'll notice as we go down through the description of this image, that it starts out with gold at the head, which is the most valuable material, and each step down the image gets less valuable until you finally get to the feet and the toes of iron and clay, which don't stick together very well, a weakness. And this whole image is standing on these weak feet. And it just kind of depicts the fact of how society has degenerated through the generations. It just kept getting worse and worse and worse and worse until finally, as the story ends here, Christ has to intervene. It's a very, very interesting outline. Now, you fill this outline in with all kinds of history and reading in Revelation, but it's just fascinating because this is the picture. This gives us this outline. And we can jump all the way down to the bottom because we're down near the bottom of this image. But anyway, this image was standing before me, said, and it was awesome. Verse 32, this image's head was of fine gold, its chest and arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze. You see how the material's getting less and less valuable. Its legs of iron. Now, iron, you know, that's still strong, but it tends to be brittle. So it has a little bit of a potential problem. Its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. You watched while a stone was cut out without hands, which struck the image on its feet of iron and clay and broke them in pieces. Now that stone was Christ. Return. Then the iron and the clay, bronze and silver and the gold, were crushed together and became like chaff from the summer threshing floor. The wind carried them away so that no trace of them was found. And the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth, referring to the mountain of the Lord, which would be set up in Jerusalem. This is the dream. Now we will tell you the interpretation before the king. So he tells him the dream, and now he's going to give him the explanation. You, O king, are a king of kings. And back then he obviously was. For the God of heaven has given you, God gave it to him, a kingdom, power, strength, and glory. And wherever the children of men dwell, or the beasts of the field and the birds of heaven, he has given them to your hand, and he has made you ruler over all of them. You are this head of gold. But after you shall arise another kingdom, inferior. See, and it keeps going, getting more and more inferior to yours, then another and a third kingdom of bronze, which shall rule over all the earth, and the fourth kingdom shall be as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron breaks in pieces and shatters all things. And like iron that crushes, the kingdom will break into pieces and crush all the others. Whereas you saw the feet and toes partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, the kingdom shall be divided. Yet the strength of iron shall be in it, just as you saw the iron mixed with ceramic clay. And as the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of clay, and this is where we are right now, right down to waiting for this to transpire, with these feet or these toes of iron and clay, and as the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly fragile. Those societies will agree for a while, but it's going to be a very weak union. It will not be like the United States, where we have all these states, and each state runs, and it's not necessarily, although there's some competition, but it's all a cooperative effort. That's not the way it is in Europe. Each one has their deeply entrenched traditions and their culture, and they don't want to give it up. And it's understandable. As you saw iron mixed with ceramic clay, they will mingle with the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, just as iron does not mix with clay. Verse 44, and in the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. So we know that when it gets down to the toes, the iron and clay, which is now happening before our very eyes and ears, it's getting closer, because Christ said, when that happens, when that really comes to fruition, when that kingdom really does take control, he says, in the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. So Christ will come with that big rock, you know, figuratively, and he will destroy the whole thing. And he will set his kingdom up, and he says, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people. In other words, nobody else is going to take over. It shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. So when God's kingdom takes over, there's not going to be a successor. Insomuch as you saw the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it broke in pieces the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, the gold, the great God has made known to the king what will come to pass after this. The dream is certain, and the interpretation is sure. Daniel saying, look, this is what's going to happen. And this is kind of our outline. And then the Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face, prostrate before Daniel, commanded that he should be presented these offerings, and they made him a ruler, and he promoted him and his friends. And Daniel went on to have a great influence in that society. But that image of the iron, of the outline, is what we. It's interesting because you can trace all these things down through history, and we're down to the end, folks, and we're watching it happen. How long will it take? I don't know. It's been 20 years since it started. How long will it take before it actually comes to fruition? But this is the first time that I've heard any kind of reports and acknowledgement by these financial experts and people on TV. Numerous times I've heard this explanation from different ones, and I've recorded them, that acknowledge the fact that Germany is the strong nation. Very interesting. And they all know potential problems, but they're going to go with it eventually anyway. Go back to Revelation 17, please. Now, as we go through Revelation, we know about the seven churches in the first few chapters. Then we get into the seven seals. The seven seals, starting out with religion, religious deception, and the four horsemen of the apocalypse. You've heard of that. And years ago, back in the 70s, we did TV broadcasts, and we hired people. Then they dressed up like these four horsemen, and they came riding across the desert, and they took this film and so on, and we used it in our telecast. Okay, so you have false religion, religious deception, which Christ predicted. Then the second one, war, and the third one famine, and the fourth one disease, and the fifth one here of the seals. In other words, we leave the horses here. Now, in the fifth seal becomes the tribulation. So all these things, just like Christ is saying, you start out with some wars and famines and earthquakes, but it keeps building and building and building. And that's what you see here in Revelation. One thing starts, and the next thing adds on top of it, and the next thing adds on top of it, and it just keeps building. And finally, you get to the tribulation, and then the sixth one is the heavenly signs. And then the seventh seal is the seventh trumpet, or the trumpets, and then you get to the woes. And all of these things can, you know, the first one doesn't stop. It just keeps going. And you keep adding and adding. But, you know, that's a whole sermon or series of sermons in itself. But eventually, you have the two witnesses and all these things. But let's get to chapter 17. And this talks about what we're talking about here. And there came one of the seven angels, verse 1, that had seven vials and talked with me, saying to me, come, and I will show unto you the judgment of the great whore that sits upon many waters. And the many waters are lands, people, countries, armies, with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication, and inhabitants of the earth have been made drunk. And let me switch to the other translation here again. Makes it a little bit easier. Okay, verse 2. With whom the kings of the earth committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth are made drunk with the wine of her fornication. So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on scarlet beast, which was full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns. And the woman was arrayed in purple, scarlet, and adorned with gold, precious stones, had a lot of power, and people respected this, having in her hand the golden cup full of abominations and the filthiness of her fornication. And verse 5, and on her forehead was written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. The world continues to get worse and worse and worse, and Satan has more and more influence here on these people. And things at this point are going very badly in relationship to the church. And I saw a woman drunk with the blood of the saints and the body and the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. So the church is not faring well during this persecution and tribulation. And when I saw her, when I say the church, certain ones in the church, obviously the majority of the church God promises to protect, but some, Christ said, if you go back into the gospel, some of you they shall cause to be put to death. Okay, the martyrs of Jesus, when I saw her, I marveled with great amazement. But the angel said to me, why are you marveling? I will tell you the mystery of the woman of the beast that carries her, which has seven heads and ten horns. Now we're looking at the ten horns here. The beast that you saw was, again, going back to this thing of Germany rising again, and is not, and will ascend out of the bottomless pit and go into perdition. And those who dwell on the earth will marvel. They're going to be surprised because this was a entity that was dead, and now here it is again. Now, this is the third time. Think about that. World War I, and then it came back again, World War II, and now it's back again, you know, like Freddy Krueger. I'm back, and no one can deny it. They don't like it. But it's the only power they can turn to, unfortunately. And those who dwell on the earth will marvel, whose names are not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they see the beast that was and is not and yet is. Okay? Here it is again. Here is the mind which has wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. These were these different kingdoms. But he says, there are also seven kings. Five are fallen or have fallen. One is, and the other has not yet come. Okay? And when he comes, he must continue for a short time. And that fits in exactly with what these ten nations are going to do. But there's going to be a single power that leads these nations. And the beast that was and is not is himself also the eighth and is of the seventh. So it's the same origin, but he finally comes up once again and is going to into perdition. And the ten horns which you saw are the ten kings who have received no kingdom as yet, but they receive authority for 1 hour as kings with the beast. So they agree. They all get together, and they're the ten toes, and they support the leader. These are of one mind, and they will give their power and authority to the beast. Now, they're not going to be, they're not happy about it right now, but look at the situation they're finding themselves in Europe. They're going to be forced to do it, whether they like it or not, and finally they'll capitulate because that's what God says is going to happen, and you know who's going to be the leader. We don't know who the specific leader is going to be, but we know the entity that he's going to come from. These will make war with the Lamb. Okay, we know that this is at the end time, that these will be the nations and the armies that will fight Christ at his return. And, of course, Christ will take care of the problem. These will make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings. And those who are with him are called, chosen, and faithful. And he said, and of course, obviously, Christ, his people will be resurrected, changed, and meet him in the air, and will descend with him. For he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those who are with him are called, chosen, and faithful. And he said to me, the waters which you saw, and this is how the Bible interprets itself, the waters which you saw, where the harlot sits, are peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues. You know, just control over the whole society. And the ten horns which you saw on the beast, these will hate the harlot, make her desolate and naked, eat her flesh, and burn her with fire, for God will put it in their hearts to fulfill his purpose and to be of one mind and to give their kingdom to the beast until the words of God are fulfilled. And the woman who you saw is that great city which reigns over the kings of the earth. Of course, we know that's Babylon. And, of course, there's a lot more to the story. But I just wanted to focus on those ten nations and the fact that they're going to have a leader that wasn't, and now is, and that leader, that power, will be in charge of those ten nations. Those ten nations will give their power, and somehow it'll all kind of filter down from the, I guess there are 17 right now that are signed up, but eventually, of course, we know England won't be one of them, and I don't know what the other Israelitish countries will do, if they will bow out as well, and there will only be 10 Gentile, I don't know. We just have to wait and find out. But God says there are going to be 10, and they will give their power to this leader, who will then be overseen by the spiritual leader, and the Pope is already calling for more unity, unification, and not so much bickering and all these things. Well, let's finally go to Thessalonians 2, because obviously 2 Thessalonians, the second chapter. When we read this, you'll see Paul understood all of this very clearly. He just made a reference to it. He didn't try to explain all the details because he knew exactly what's going to be coming. Of course, he was. They all thought it was going to happen in their time, and it didn't. It took way, way longer, like 2,000 years longer. So how long will this take? It's already taken 20. People have been born. People have died. The church has gone through a lot of trauma in the last 20 years. How much longer will it take? The reason I'm saying that is I want you to realize we can't set dates. And the answer is we don't know. But we do know what's going to happen. And we can open our eyes and see it is happening. It's not going to happen anymore. When I was a kid, I heard these sermons about prophecy in detail, very dramatic. This is going to happen and that's going to happen. And I see it happening now. I'm living through what I was told when I was a teenager. It is happening. How long will all this take? Once again, I don't know. Nobody else knows. You just have to keep watching and praying. But it is happening. No question about it. And Paul knew that these things were going to happen. And he includes a few other things. He said, verse 1 of chapter 2 of 2 Thessalonians, "Now we beseech you, brethren, by the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ," so he's talking about that, "and by our gathering together unto him, that you be not soon shaken in mind or troubled, neither by spirit nor by word." So if Satan tries to discourage the church, which he is attempting to do currently, he says that you be not soon shaken in mind or troubled, neither by spirit nor by word or by letter, as from us. And it was false ministers trying to send a letter in his name, as that the day of Christ is at hand. Okay? So Satan will be trying to discourage us and attack us and make us, unreceptive and against God. He says, "Let no man deceive you by any means, for that day shall not come except there come a falling away first, and that man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition." Now, if you go back to Revelation 24, you're going to see that Christ said when the tribulation or persecution of the church starts, many, he said, will be offended, which is interesting. I'll just read that to you real quick. You don't have to turn back there. "All these things are beginning of sorrows, and they will deliver you up to be afflicted, and they shall kill you, and you shall be hated of all nations for my name's sake. And then shall many be offended, and shall betray one another, and shall hate one another. And many false prophets will arise, because the iniquity shall abound, the love of many shall wax cold." He says, endure to the end. So we go back here to 2 Thessalonians again. "Don't let any man deceive you by any means, for that day shall not come except there be a falling away first, and that man of sin revealed, the son of perdition." Now this is way at the end. But we're sitting here watching this come together. Okay, and eventually, if we live long enough, and if this happens soon enough, we'll see this man revealed. We don't know who it is now, but Paul says, you'll see who this is. He'll be revealed. "Who opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God, or that is worship, so that he as God..." So he proclaims himself in God's place, "sits in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God." Don't you remember, he says, that when I was yet with you, I told you of these things? He was just reminding them. And now you know what withholds or what's being held back, that he might be revealed in his time. So Paul knew that. He didn't know who it was at that time either, but it would happen. "For the mystery of iniquity does already work." Society continued at that time and is continuing to get worse and worse. "Only he who now lets will let until he be taken out of the way." In other words, God's allowing this to transpire until he removes it. "And then shall the wicked be revealed, whom the Lord shall consume with the spirit of his mouth and shall destroy with the brightness of his coming." So when Christ returns, he will destroy this leader, which is what it says in Revelation. "Even him whose coming is after the working of Satan, with all power and signs and lying wonders." So there are going to be some pretty amazing things happening at that time. and with all deceivable of unrighteousness in them that perish, because they received not the love of the truth that they might be saved. And I've emphasized that to you before. We have to love, not put up with, not just have the checklist righteousness, but we have to love the truth. Great peace, God says, has all of those who love God's law, and nothing shall offend them. They receive not the love of the truth that they might be saved. You want to be saved, you have to love the truth. And for this cause, God shall send them strong delusion, because they don't want to follow God's way. So he'll send them strong delusion that they will believe a lie. They'll just go along with this false person, and they'll think, oh, wow, look at all the things he's doing. He must be God. That they all might be damned who believe not the truth, but had pleasure in unrighteousness. They enjoy it. They love it. They want to do it. It's their choice. They rejected the truth. And he keeps going. So this goes right along with what we just read. Of course, Paul understood that. He said at the end, this is the power that's going to be leading the world. And he'll be there at the time Jesus Christ returns, and he will be destroyed. That evil power and leadership will be destroyed by Jesus Christ as he returns. And they will be thrown into the lake of fire at that time, the beast and the false prophet. So I hope I have made a little more clarity for you in what is happening, because it is very confusing. You hear all these acronyms thrown out, you know, which represents the international banking system, and then the national or the European national banking system, and this thing and that thing, and you know, what in the world are they talking about? So it's pretty simple. The banks royally screwed up. Okay? Now they're in a bad way. And they have been put into this position, which makes a perfect opening for the prophecies to begin to take place. And they look and they go, I see Germany, they're the strong one, they could pull us out, but we don't want to be under their thumb. Well, buddy, you will be. Just give it some time. How that's going to transpire, I don't know. But keep your eyes open. And as my grandfather would say, you'll find out.